This week on the Allegheny Front, we follow the pipeline to New York, where some say a proposal to store natural gas products near a lake is too risky.
This is a water source for over 100,000 people. There's no other water source. So what are people supposed to do?
I'm Carol Holsapple. Also, clean energy jobs are up in Pennsylvania, but are renewables in the state lagging behind?
We estimate that we could double or triple the amount of wind that's currently installed in Pennsylvania easily.
Plus, we take a deep look inside office culture, our own, to report on the air conditioning wars. It's chilling. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. This summer, we've been looking at issues related to pipelines, following natural gas and other fuels that are the byproducts of fracking as they're transported from underground wells to our homes. When energy companies produce more than people need, they have to find a place to store it. There are over 400 underground storage facilities in the U.S., in places like old oil wells and depleted aquifers. And that's how some residents and businesses in the Finger Lakes region of New York got involved in a standoff over a plan to store natural gas and propane in a salt cavern near their drinking water. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant went to Seneca Lake to find out more.
Driving around Seneca Lake, evidence of industry is everywhere.
You have to try our rosé.
The wine industry, that is. There are fields upon fields of grapevines, with wineries and tasting rooms nestled along the lakeside, like this one.
My name is Lou Damiani. I'm co-owner of Damiani Wine Cellars here on beautiful Seneca Lake.
Damiani grew up around here. He and his partner started clearing land and planting grapes in the early 1990s.
And realized the revolution that was taking place here in the grapes we could grow and the wines we could produce.
In recent years, internationally known vintners have moved to the Finger Lakes. The industry has blossomed into more than 100 wineries, distilleries, and breweries. It's been named a top destination for wine lovers. Still, Damiani has kept his job at Cornell University.
It's a struggle. It's a tough, competitive business. And every little thing matters in this business. The main part of it is tourism.
Tourism. It's a $3 billion a year industry in the Finger Lakes, employing nearly 60,000 people. On the late spring weekend, I visited the town of Watkins Glen on the southern edge of the lake was packed. And the nearby state park, it's one of the most visited in the country. We could barely squeeze through some spots. There were so many people taking selfies. Many tourists come to taste and buy wine. They also boat and fish on Seneca Lake, a deep and salty lake that supplies drinking water to 100,000 people. Looking out the tasting room window over the grapevines, Damiani points across the lake to the U.S. salt plant. He and others who work and live here worry about a plan under consideration by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation to store natural gas, propane, and butane in the salt caverns. This is the sound of salt being packaged and shipped out at the plant in Watkins Glen for pharmaceuticals, cleaning, and just regular table salt. Salt has been mined under Seneca Lake for over 100 years. The company that's now called Crestwood bought U.S. Salt in 2008. Crestwood declined an interview for this story, but they got me in touch with Mike Gilbert, a union worker at the plant.
I work in the shipping department. I've been here for about 15 years now.
I caught up with Gilbert around 8 a.m. during his second shift. He says to get the salt, they pump millions of gallons of water down thousands of feet into the caverns at high pressure. The salt dissolves in the water, and then they pump it back up.
Well, yeah, it's a brine. Brine is a liquid. It looks just like water. You wouldn't know unless you actually taste it that it's very salty.
The brine is stored in open ponds or pits. It's heated to evaporate the water. Crestwood wants to use the salt caverns to store fuels.
What they're proposing to do is put propane down in there.
1.5 million gallons of propane, as well as 600,000 gallons of butane. The company already stores natural gas in the salt caverns and wants to expand that capacity. Gilbert says the United Steelworkers support the project. Crestwood plans to add up to 17 full-time jobs.
I would love to be able to give 17 people the same chance that I've had to raise my family. If 17 more people could do that in this area, that'd be phenomenal.
But a lot of people don't think it's worth the risk.
We are Seneca Lake! We
More than 600 people have been arrested protesting Crestwood during the years its storage plans have been under consideration. They regularly stand at Crestwood's front gates with signs like "Make Love, Not Methane," and "We Are Seneca Lake." Anti-fracking activist David Braun of California recently joined them.
I am risking arrest with you all today because of disasters with gas storage that I have seen up close. Don't let it happen here.
Braun is talking about the huge leak from Aliso Canyon, where they store gas in depleted oil fields. It spewed methane into the air for nearly 4 months before being plugged in February.
Like the facility here at Seneca Lake, the Aliso Canyon facility was created from unlined holes in the ground that were never engineered to store anything, let alone highly pressurized, flammable gas.
The New York DEC found last year that opponents have not provided adequate proof to back up their concerns about Crestwood's plans, although it hasn't given final approvals for the project. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has already approved the natural gas expansion project.
And so based on that, I don't know why it just can't get going. It's really a political situation.
I met Philip Barnes, a retired security officer, on the docks in downtown Watkins Glen. He's a legislator in Schuyler County, where this is all being debated.
It's totally up to the governor to make a decision. And it's been 6, 7, 8 years now in the making.
Governor Andrew Cuomo banned fracking in New York a couple of years ago. This spring, the DEC denied water permits for the Constitution natural gas pipeline from Pennsylvania to Albany. Opponents of Crestwood's plans want the DEC to continue this anti-fracking trend. They say the company is trying to make Seneca Lake a hub for fracked fuels from Pennsylvania to supply the entire Northeast, and they want the administration to stop it. Many are worried about the project's impact on water quality.
Sama Creek Vineyards, this is Tina.
Tina Haslett manages a vineyard here that's been in her husband's family since 1852.
We're already, Seneca Lake is the saltiest lake in the Finger Lakes, and it's because of those salt caverns.
Haslett points to research that shows moving pressurized fuels into and out of the salt caverns could push the salinity of the lakes even higher.
They've already told, they're telling people, if you're young or elderly or have had blood pressure, don't drink this water. This is the water source for over 100,000 people. There's no other water source. So, you know, what are people supposed to do?
Geologist John Halfman lives here and has been studying the salinity issue in Seneca Lake for 25 years. He agrees with the DEC. Storing fuels in the salt caverns should be safe.
If everything goes as planned, nothing's going to happen, in which case I think it's a good idea. If there is some unfortunate mistake, then it's a horrible idea.
The DEC would not comment for this story. Crestwood and the community are awaiting their permitting decisions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Now from New York to rural Pennsylvania, where a sense of place has a central role in a new play about fracking and the experiences of a family living in Washington County. Paul Cruz is the playwright and a co-founder of Hatch Arts Collective, which is mounting the production in Pittsburgh this summer. I dropped in on a rehearsal of the play, Driftless, and Cruz told me more about the meaning of the title.
The word Driftless comes from a geological explanation, and we were really interested in rooting the text in geological realities and that kind of deep history. The really strange thing is that this one of the key ingredients in fracking is sand. And the largest and best naturally occurring supply of frack sand is in a region called the Driftless Area, which is western Wisconsin, eastern Minnesota, northern Iowa. That's where I grew up. So I did not know before 2 years ago that the sand that I walked on as a kid is being dug up, brought to western Pennsylvania, and injected into the ground to extract natural gas. Learning that fact, for me in a lot of ways, was the spark that lit the fuse for this project. So what Driftless means is that it's land that has been untouched by glaciers. And so there's something really special about western Pennsylvania in that it's a beautiful part of the world. And it's a world that, you know, is now experiencing a new kind of natural resource extraction.
the idea for where the story of the play came from is from real people, right?
Our process for working on this play has been about 3 years. We started with a small workshop process in 2013, and we did a play investigating how environmental activism in the nonprofit world intersected about fracking. And from that, we had another workshop where we gathered a group of about 9 artists, and together we took a look at the transcripts from a trial of a bunch of protesters who were arrested trying to shut down a frack sand mine. Using those two processes, I, over the last year, have been interviewing about 30 folks who live in Western Pennsylvania and are in some way connected to hydraulic fracturing. So that has meant activists. It's meant folks who have directly benefited from fracking, folks who are pro-fracking, folks who are anti-fracking, folks who are interested in fracking. And one of the things that I hope folks understand after experiencing this play is that it is complicated and that it's possible for something to have economic benefits while still causing real environmental harm. And that until we admit both of those things, it's going to be really hard to progress.
One of the characters, Colin, works on a fracking well pad in Pennsylvania, and he's also a recovering addict. And there's a scene where the audience sees him working on the well pad, and two other characters are talking, one about the definition of addiction, how you know you're an addict, and the other about the process of hydraulic fracturing. So I'm just curious what you're trying to say about the nature of fracking there and fossil fuel extraction.
There's two reasons that addiction plays a role in the text. The first and most immediate is that what's true for Washington County and several rural counties around Pittsburgh is that there is a big problem with heroin addiction. I am not an expert in that, so I can't say for sure, but in talking to a lot of people who live in those areas, many people have drawn a connection between heroin addiction beginning and the fracking boom that's been going on. Whether it's causal, we don't know, but what is true is that they've been existing at the same time. The other thing that occurred to me as I was writing that I've been thinking about is how similar our relationship to fossil fuels is to addiction. And by our, I mean our way of life, my way of life, the fact that I drive a car here, the fact that I can't move through a room without touching at least a dozen petroleum products. And so the analogy of an addiction seems really appropriate to me. We have a dependence, and it's a dependence that is causing us harm.
Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania is a very heavily Catholic place. And so I have to ask about the role of religion in the play, because it's pretty irreverent. I think there might even be a trigger warning in the beginning of the text.
Absolutely. Yeah, there is. I wouldn't call it irreverent, but I would call it maybe raw. The existence of religion in the text is really personal to me, also grounded in the fact that religion and Catholicism do play a huge role in people's lives in this part of the world and in many parts of the world. But for me, my way into activism was through the Catholic worker movement. My family was part of a Catholic worker community growing up, and connecting activism to religion has been a part of my understanding of the world for a very long time. And so seeing that played out on stage is cathartic for me, and connecting those things is powerful for me. And I hope it is for other people as well. I think that people turn to their deepest beliefs often when you're confronted with something this large.
So say who the religious figures in your play are and why you chose them.
The play is guided by two saints who share wisdom not only spiritually, but also scientifically. The two saints are Saint Peter. I chose St. Peter because the word Peter comes from the Greek petros, which literally means stone or rock. And there's a passage in the Bible where Jesus turns to Peter and says, "You are my rock, and on this rock I will build my church." And the analogy between Peter as rock and the geology in the play was really interesting to me. The other saint is St. Barbara, a medieval saint, I think the 1300s. St. Barbara is the patron saint of miners and explosions. Because there are small explosions involved in the process of fracking, I wonder what St. Barbara would have to say about it.
Well, playwright Paul Cruz and his collaborators Nicole Shiro and Adil Mansour acted out a little scene when I visited the rehearsal that might give a clue to this question. It features St. Barbara on a beach with a childlike St. Peter who's building a sandcastle.
A typical frack sand mining operation begins with removal of vegetation and topsoil.
St. Barbara destroys a little bit of St. Peter's sandcastle.
What are you doing?
In some cases, explosive charges may be used to break the sandstone into smaller chunks.
You're ruining it!
St. Barbara destroys more of St. Peter's sandcastle.
These chunks go to a crusher, which breaks them into individual grains of sand.
St. Barbara completely obliterates St. Peter's sandcastle.
No!
Scene. That's from a new work about fracking, Driftless, which premieres in Pittsburgh on August 11th. There's more about that on our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And we should say that Driftless is supported in part by the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the PNC Charitable Trust. These foundations also support the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Does this scenario sound familiar? Your office mate is typing away happily at his computer while you're shivering resentfully wrapped in a sweater.
Sometimes I was a little vindictive. I would push it all the way to hot. And so when he would come in the morning, you know, he'd feel like he was boiling.
Coming up on the Allegheny Front, how to keep your cool and save energy when things heat up over the office air conditioner. Stay tuned. Your coworkers will thank you for it. Clean energy was a common talking point in many of the speeches at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia this week. Bernie Sanders warned about the impacts of climate change, more drought and floods, if we don't move away from fossil fuels. And he said the shift could actually help our economy.
We can create hundreds of thousands of jobs transforming our energy system.
Well, a new Clean Jobs report says there's already been a 15% growth in clean energy jobs in Pennsylvania since 2014. But most of that was in energy efficiency, like HVAC installation. Jim Spencer is CEO and founder of EverPower Wind Holdings, a company that owns and operates wind farms in Pennsylvania and several other states. He says 15 years ago, when he got started in renewable energy, it was touch and go. But now,
we're no longer the redheaded stepchild. We're pretty mainstream, and it's fun to have been a part of that.
I met Spencer at EverPower's headquarters in Pittsburgh to talk about the new clean energy jobs report. He said jobs in the wind industry are also up, and there's reason to believe that trend will continue.
One of the things that's propelling the industry right now is that we have a five-year horizon on the production tax credit for wind. That is the first time that has ever happened since the tax credit was initiated maybe 20 some years ago. It's a federal tax credit, and it represents about a third of the capital cost of a renewable energy facility. So what that has done is really given investors and the market some certainty on the regulatory policy going forward, and that's very helpful for the industry.
Are the numbers in the report encouraging to you?
They're very encouraging. It's interesting. The report says there are roughly 65,000 green energy jobs in the state of Pennsylvania. And I wanted to take a look at the number of Pennsylvanians working in our coal mines. And I think that number is less than 8,000. So I think it's good to compare and contrast.
So that begs the question, what could Pennsylvania do to grow more of these kinds of jobs?
One thing which we could do is to increase our renewable portfolio standard. As you know, Pennsylvania, like most states, has a mandate that a certain percentage of the power generation must come from non-carbon producing sources of electricity. Now, when that mandate was passed, it was a pretty progressive benchmark. Since then, we've seen other states be much more aggressive in terms of their targets for renewable energy. And so Pennsylvania has really fallen behind.
Is finding workers to do these jobs at different levels in your industry difficult?
The majority of workers that we employ are during the construction of a facility. And there have been some difficulties, especially during the peak of the Marcellus shale industry. There was a shortage of some of the trades. So a large number of, for instance, pipe fitters and welders were working in the gas industry. I think in terms of operators for our facilities, the skills that operators at coal facilities in Pennsylvania would have are very easily transferable. There is some specialized knowledge, but the idea of maintaining a power plant, whether it's a coal facility, a nuclear facility, a wind farm, those skills are transferable. And so I'm hugely in favor of programs which help train those workers for some of the clean energy opportunities that exist today. We should be taking care of people who have really dedicated their lives to powering, whether it's been a coal facility, a nuclear facility. They have served, you know, very well in those positions, and I think we owe it to them to retrain them as technology changes.
Does there need to be a bigger push on the federal level? Of course, the Clean Power Plan, the renewable energy is part of that. That's on hold at the moment. But what else needs to happen at the federal level?
I could give you a wish list. I think a tremendous amount has happened at the federal level. The reason that has happened, because the politics on this subject are difficult, but I think the reason that, for instance, we were able to get an extension of the production tax credit for wind is that commonplace people are beginning to see the impacts of climate change. And notwithstanding what a minority of our politicians and people believe, the science is overwhelming. So whether it's wildfires in the West or flooding in the Southeast, this is confronting people on a daily basis. So the general populace is in favor of doing more to prevent climate change. You know, what the federal government could do, and I believe is the most efficient way to address climate change, is through regulating carbon, a carbon tax. Unfortunately, it's unclear whether that could get enough votes in Congress to pass. So we've relied on the states.
Both major party candidates for president support fracking and natural gas development. So can wind and other renewables compete?
You know, the real answer to that question is it depends upon the price of natural gas. In this area, because of Marcellus, sometimes the price of gas is below a dollar. And so if a gas generator is using inexpensive natural gas like that, the cost of production is significantly lower, and it's very hard to compete. Now, we do not believe that these current prices of natural gas are sustainable over the long run. We no longer believe in $8 natural gas, which was a common view a few years ago, but we really think that $4 to $5 natural gas is probably sustainable. And at that level, renewables competes very well.
Solar has the biggest share of the renewables pie in Pennsylvania. So what's the future for wind energy in the state?
We have the capacity within the state in terms of land and wind resource to double or triple the amount of installed capacity. And I think we will get there as a result of the Clean Power Plan. A factor that's great in Pennsylvania is that we're located in the PJM grid. And so we have the ability to build wind in the state and export it to other states that don't have the resource that we do, North Carolina and Kentucky, which are also part of the PJM system, and is there required to comply with the new standards of the Clean Power Plan that creates a market for our wind projects, because they do have the opportunity to build solar there, but those geographies aren't really great for wind.
Jim Spencer is CEO and founder of EverPower Wind Holdings, and we'll link to that Pennsylvania Clean Jobs report at our website. That's AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. It's been extremely hot out there this summer, so air conditioning has been a lifesaver for many of us. But companies spend a lot of energy and money on cooling their offices in the summertime. Buildings account for about 40% of our energy consumption in the U.S., and a third of that goes to air conditioning. But in many cases, our approach to AC isn't even doing what it's supposed to do, namely making people comfortable. The Allegheny Front's Lou Bluin has more.
Forget the tense staff meetings, forget the latest workplace romance. By far the hottest drama in the office building in the summertime is the war over the thermostat.
I wouldn't call it a war. I'd call it a dispute, and I think I would also call it an uneasy peace.
That's WESA Afternoon host Larkin Page Jacobs, and in our office here at the radio station, she's one half of an ongoing head-to-head over the temperature in the on-air studio.
Josh comes in and turns it all the way to cold for his morning shift.
She's talking about Josh Rawlerson, WESA's Morning Edition host.
But then when I come in to do my shift, it is freezing. I didn't really know how to address it. Sometimes I was a little vindictive. I would push it all the way to hot. And so when he would come in the morning, you know, he'd feel like he was boiling.
I get in here 4 a.m. and I come into the studio and it is stifling.
That is Josh Rawlerson.
So I always have to put the thermostat on full cold. And it became quickly apparent to us that we couldn't agree on where it should be set.
And that, as you probably know, if you work in an office, is not all that uncommon. There are even studies to back that up.
Well, if you look at studies of office workers and the kinds of things that they complain about, thermal issues are number one.
Cornell's Alan Hedge has been studying this issue for more than 40 years. In fact, he published the first research on a topic that's getting a lot of attention today, the differences in thermal comfort between men and women in the workplace.
And what that research showed, of course, was that women were experiencing more issues at the temperatures that were then being set in the environment, which are the temperatures that still tend to be used today.
In fact, a study in the journal Nature Climate Change found that the standards of comfort that have endured since the Depression era are likely based on the metabolic rate of a 40-year-old, 155-pound man. And the problem with that, Hedge says, is that women, for a variety of biological and cultural reasons, tend to be colder than men in offices. But Hedge has also found evidence that the average office temp of 70 degrees in the summer isn't really doing anybody much good when it comes to productivity. He says it's always been assumed that if people are a little bit cool, they'll do more work.
In reality, we find the opposite in office workplaces. We find that when people are in an environment that they find to be too cold, typically a temperature like 68 to 70, they do up to a third less work on their computers than if they're in an environment that is more comfortable.
That would be something around 76 degrees, which Hedge says is the temperature where workers are the most productive. Which means, bottom line, we are over-air conditioning our workplaces in the U.S. In fact, geography plays a huge role in what your perception of comfort is. He's found that people from tropical countries prefer the thermostat in the 80s. And in Japan, they've had success cranking the thermostat up to 82 while relaxing the clothing policy at work. Meanwhile, in the U.S., we continue to throw away a ton of money and energy by loading up on weapons to win our own office AC wars.
One of the ironies is that when you look at the sales of personal heaters, the peak months are July and August, which is crazy. It means the company is paying money to overcool the air. And then you've got people who are actually trying to warm the environment up.
Where we're heading, Hedge says, is into an era of more and more customization. Right now, Cornell is helping to develop a technology that sort of does the inverse of what we do now. It would leave temperatures a little higher in the office overall and then provide high-tech cooling at the desk level for people who get too warm. He says it could be on the market by 2019, but we don't need to wait that long to turn up our thermostats, let people wear shorts to work, give workers desk fans, and in doing so, make everyone around the office a little bit more comfortable. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front, where we're already wearing shorts, no desk fans yet. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. Our series Follow the Pipeline is funded by the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.